could say all the things that I should say, say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart, remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me, then you'd see and agree that every man should be free. I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do, though I'm way overdue. I'd be starting anew. Well, I wish.
Good morning. You're listening to Voices from the Prison Action Network, produced by the Hudson Mohawk Independent Media Center. I'm
Hello?
Judith, and
yeah?
With us today by phone is Ricochet from New York City, where he's a student at Mercy College now, but a few years ago he was in prison. Welcome to the program, Rick. I can hear you there in the background.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, good morning, and why don't we just start off, what are you studying?
Well, I'm a behavioral science major. I was a history major, but I switched my major to behavioral science because it's probably easier to find a job in that field than it is in history.
Uh-huh. And how did your experience in prison influence that decision?
Well, there are a few grassroots organizations on Rikers Island and in New York State on prison system. And I became a part of a couple of those organizations. One was Black Studies. And I began to learn about the undisclosed history of this country, things that I would never taught in school. And I just got a profound interest. I gained a profound interest and really piqued my interest and I just kept with it, and I stayed going to libraries, and you know, I forewent going to the yard and, you know, playing basketball, and I spent a lot of time in the libraries, in the law library and the general library, and I began to read different authors like Noam Chomsky, J.A. Rogers, Kwame Ture, Howard Zinn. And as I read more of these authors, black and white, the true history began to reveal itself. And it just really piqued my interest, and I just stayed with it. And when I was released from custody, I went to a few different institutions of higher learning, and a few of them were concerned about my criminal past. But Mercy College was willing to work with me, and I think that I have not let them down. The last two semesters, I was on a dean's list. I had a 3.8 and a 4.0.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
So tell our listeners something about your experiences.
In prison?
Yeah, in prison. And
well, the one thing that I would say it's probably the most important thing today is the fact that while I was in prison in Comstock and Dannemora Clinton, we they have a part of the prison called industry. The industry pays a little more than the regular 23 cents a day. But in those places that have industry, we end up making working for companies such as MCI, Sprint, AT&T, we worked for companies making for TWA, made telephone reservations for TWA, data entry for Chevron. All of these different things that I could not do on the street. Well, when I did apply for them, I was not even considered for a job. As soon as I was incarcerated, I was doing the exact same thing. And right now, I believe that the PIC, it stands for Prison Industrial Complex, is basically company oriented now. A lot of the corporations are in. You have CCA, the Correction Corporations of America. They have came into the prisons, and you even have outside entities from other countries coming in, trying to privatize the prisons. And the more privatization that goes on, the less services will be rendered to those who are incarcerated. And ultimately, I believe that in the long run, a lot of people will suffer under those conditions, because it's about profit, not about, you know, rehabilitating people when it comes down to private corporations. Me, myself, something else that's not talked about a lot, I was a victim of a vicious, brutal assault attempt on my life in 1997 in Rikers Island. Six corrections officers, including two captains, Raymond Bethea and another officer named Captain Richardson, who pretty much had you could call it a prison gang, because some of the officers, they bond together, and together they form like a mini gang. So you have a lot of that going on. For instance, what happened to Mr. Davis in New Orleans. Well, that was a tragic assault indeed, but the assault on my life was 10 times worse. And in fact, there are people and right now who are suffering from different are going through it.
Mm-hmm.
You're going through the same thing, and it's just that people don't realize that, you know, when you're on the street. And there's a police officer who's overzealous or whatever. A lot of people can see that. There's, you know, people can witness that and say, well, you know, aren't you going a little above and beyond your duty? But when, you know, that's that blue wall of silence. But there is a gray wall of silence. And when that gray wall of silence works, no one knows what's going on. No one can help you, because no one can see, get past those prison walls. So a lot of times when someone is assaulted and they're a prisoner is assaulted, there is no recourse for that prisoner.
Yeah, I was going to ask. I mean, that sounds like a very frightening experience, and I wondered
if you had any
recourse.
Yeah, well, the only real recourse you have at that point, because 9 times out of 10, just like in any police assault situation, they're going to charge the inmate with assaulting the officer, regardless that the officers assaulted them. And 9 times out of 10, the other officers will back them up when they go in front of the magistrate. So you really don't ever win. I have witnessed one young man who, during a search on Rikers Island, and it was a African-American female captain who came into the dorm after the search was over, and this guy was instructed to begin to clean up the dorm, and this African-American female captain came in, and she saw him and that did not realize that he was instructed to come out and clean up, and she grabbed him by his neck, and she had on those you know how a lot of women get their nails done. They have these very, very long nails. And by the time she grabbed him, she had dug and raked 3 long rakes in his neck, and then the rest of the officers jumped on him for no reason. And then he went to Bing Court and went and got 180 days across the board, which meant 180 days loss of packages, 180 days loss of phone calls, 180-day loss of vision, and 180 days in the box, SHU, and all just because he was following the directions.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I've seen stuff like that. I have been a victim of that kind of stuff.
How did you survive that assault? I mean, how badly hurt were you, and did you get medical attention?
Yes, I've had 5 surgeries on my right, on my left wrist, and I'm in a lieu of exploratory surgery on my right knee, and then corrective surgery after that. I was in that day. This happened December 23rd, 1997. I was taken to Bellevue Hospital, where I was kept for 3 days in intensive care unit, and I pulled through ultimately. And when they sent me back to Rikers Island, there was an administrative separation placed between me and those officers who were involved.
Mm-hmm.
Those officers are, I know that one of them had problems, psychological problems, where he was ready to retire from work-related stress. The other officer, I believe, from my understanding, he's had a lot of problems with other officers. So, you know, right now we're in the process of waiting for the court system to call us, and we're prepared to go to trial. I'm prepared to have my day in court on that.
Okay. So how many years did you spend in prison?
Well, the last time I was away, I spent approximately a year and a half. I was sentenced to a 1.5 to 3.
Mm-hmm.
And I was released on my first parole board. First of all, the thing is, I was there for a crime I didn't commit. And Charles Hines, the Brooklyn District Attorney, who was very tough at the time, he sent in my sentencing minutes a message to the parole board that he felt that I should be released at my first board because he felt that I was not guilty of this crime, but because the assistant DA kept pushing it, and because I had already acquired a record, they didn't want to just let me go.
Wow.
So
you're saying the head district attorney suggested that you get the lightest sentence possible, basically, but
right,
allowed the prosecution to take place nevertheless.
Right. Right, exactly.
That's very interesting.
Exactly. And the judge, and they came, and they made, because I was going to go to trial because I didn't commit the crime. But the attorney who I had a court-appointed attorney,
mm-hmm.
who came to me and told me, look, this is your exposure. She said, 6 to 12 is the least you can get if you go to trial. And she said, but your record, you're not going to win. But if you take this, what we call cop-out, which means you are actually confessing to the crime, but a cop-out is not a confession. I think people need to understand that when someone says, oh, I cop-out, I took the lesser sentence, especially when it comes to impoverished people like myself. It's more of a situation of they're going to lock me up regardless. Should I go away for 12 years or should I go away for a year and a half? And 9 times out of 10, you know, unless you got a strong family network who's willing to be there and support you through the entire thing, you're going to take the year and a half because you can see yourself a year and a half walking again as a free man. Although that is a blemish on your record to have that felony there, it's much easier for a person to see a year and a half down the line than it is for them to see 12 years down the line. So.
Yeah. I'm going to just pause here a moment to remind our listeners that they're tuned in to WRPI, Indie Media Radio, and this is Voices from the Prison Action Network. Our guest today is Ricochet, who's telling us about his experiences while he was in prison, and hopefully we'll find out what the rest of the journey to the present as a college student has been like. Ricochet, so you released at your first parole board, which means that you then were on parole. Are you still on parole?
No, I completed my parole in 1999.
Oh, okay. Can you tell us something about what parole was like?
Well, at first, it wasn't the first time I was on parole. I had been upstate before. I'm just really talking about the last time that I was upstate. But I know that when I was upstate in the 80s, you didn't have to pay for being on parole. But when I came home in 1999, the parole instructed me that I had to pay $30 a month to be on parole. Now, this is in concordance with what's happening in the prison system in upstate New York, and that is the fact that now if you get a ticket, or if you have to go, like for instance, a behavioral ticket, and you get wrote up by an officer for not following an order or something like that, you have to pay $5 for that ticket. You also, if you need to go to sick call, let's say you come down sick, you have to pay $5 for that. Also, when I went upstate in the 80s, when you got to reception, and they know you were going to a facility in which the weather would be very, very cold, they would give you thermal socks and thermal underwears and a heavy overcoat. Today in reception, they don't give you any of that stuff. If you don't have family members, it's just out of luck. So the difference is now, on parole and upstate, everything is about making money. And no longer is it about rehabilitation and getting you back acclimated to society. Now it's more just, you know, keep them coming back. We got to keep the recidivism rate. We got to keep these beds filled, you know, and that's the impression I get.
Mm-hmm. Wow, this is the first time that I heard about paying to be for medical attention. I had heard about parole, but I'd forgotten it. It's just so... It's unbelievable to me, actually.
Yes.
And you don't have, of course, any choice. I was tempted to say, so what happens if you don't pay it? But obviously, you don't pay it, you go back to jail. You don't pay it for medical attention, I guess you don't get it.
Yeah, no. You don't pay up front. All of your money goes into your account. In the state prison system, you don't hold cash money. All the money goes into your account. So automatically, once you make a appearance, when next time you go look at your check your account, $5 will be gone. They take it out automatically.
Yes. But when you're on parole, that you don't still have an account, do you?
Well, not on parole. On parole, you have to pay it yourself.
Yeah.
Or what they'll do is they'll have your check garnished. They'll take allotments from your check. If you're gainfully employed, because you have to prove that to your parole officer anyway, and once they know that, you have to pay $30 a month now to be on parole. That's crazy.
So what was? I imagine when you get out on parole, you have to have housing. You have to find housing. You have to feed yourself, and you have to find a job.
Right.
Did you have family to stay with?
Nope. Actually, I'm still homeless. I'm still trying to find a place to live. I have a few friends who I stay with here and there. Also, I get a lot of help from my from our like-minded people at WBAI.
Uh-huh.
They assist me, you know, here and there. So they help me get through. But, you know, right now I'm having a problem finding housing. Because I'm in school I'm holding down 18 credits. My last two semesters, I was on the dean's list, like I said.
Yeah.
And I'm holding 18 credits. And I'm the oldest, at 40, I'm the oldest full-time, daytime student in the school. So they look like the Dean Cordero, and Assistant Dean Monica Foote. You know, they call me into the office, and they tell me, look, we're looking up to you to set an example for younger students. So you know, I have to be there. I have to go do my study and research. So it makes it difficult for me because I can't work full time mm-hmm. under those conditions. So, you know, right now, my little student worker money has ran out. Mm-hmm. I was working for the student federal student worker program, but my federal student money has run out. I think I have maybe 3 more weeks left of that. Then after that, I don't know how I'm going to survive and stay in school. But, you know, God is good, and I'm going to keep my faith.
Mm-hmm. So did you go right into school after you get out of prison, or was there a period of time when you were out on the streets looking for work?
Yes. There was a period of time where I tried to work, but my injuries, that the injuries that I sustained during that assault in 1997, when I came home in 1999, I was still going back to Bellevue Hospital and Lincoln Hospital for my knee and Bellevue for my wrist and having surgeries done. So even at that time, I had to collect public assistance, and that was the only way to stay alive because I was unable to work. I was physically unable to work.
Mm.
Today, I still have physical ailments, although I can do certain types of work, but it would be a big strain on my arm. I have titanium in my wrist because of that assault. And I can't really put a lot of weight on my knee. So, you know, it'd just be really difficult for me to do any menial labor. Mm-hmm. But I could probably do office-type work. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, the only problem I have is trying to find hours that fit around my school schedule, and that's difficult.
Yeah, that's always difficult for students. Tell me again, your major now is?
Yes.
Is
behavioral science.
And what do you plan to do with that degree when you graduate? And how many more years do you have before you graduate?
Well, I'm a junior now. Okay. I graduate at the end of next year. The end of next year, December 2006.
Mm-hmm.
So right now I'm also doing an internship with the PROMESA program. PROMESA is substance abuse counseling and teen counseling and family counseling agency that helps those who are, you know, going through problems with the criminal justice system. A lot of youth are mandated to go. A lot of adults are also mandated to go. And I go there. I do my internship there. And I work with youth there. And I try to impart them with the benefit of my experiences. Because I may not could tell them exactly what to do, but I think I could show them what not to do.
Mm.
Not to end up like I did. So, although I do try to use the fact that, you know, I've been poor all my entire life. My entire family's been poor, been through the prison system. And I try to explain to them, listen, if I can go through what I've been through, it's not too late for you at 17. You know, if I can go back to school at 40, there's no reason why you can't get an education at 17 and 18. I try my best to explain to them, a lot of the youth, how to deal with the police when approached by the police, how to stay calm, answer the questions, follow directions, and hopefully nothing, you know, will go further than that. And talking about conflict resolution, we talk about conflict resolution, talk about alternatives to violence, talk about different situations in family, with family. You know, I myself came up at the age of 3, I scalded myself with hot water, and I was taken away from who at the time was an intravenous drug user, my mother, and my father was mentally incapacitated. So I was raised in the state system and institutions, group homes or foster homes, all the way from the age of 3 to 17 when they put me out. So, you know, I try to impart that to some of the youth there that if, you know, you got a family, you have a support network, you can make it, you can win. You don't have to end up in jail for the rest of your life. You don't have to end up poor on the streets the rest of your life. You can make it.
I want to find out when you sort of turned your life around. Like, what happened?
Well, the last time when I went away for the crime, 1997, I was with a girl, and she was a girl who I was seeing. And she was living in this really broken down, ratty building in Brooklyn. And, you know, but she was really nice. And there were people in the building on the first and in the second and the third floor that was selling drugs out of their apartments. Well, one day she asked me to open the door for her two girlfriends. I went downstairs, opened the door for her two girlfriends. There was a guy with them. I didn't pay him any mind. I came back upstairs. About 20 minutes later, she asked me to go to the store and get her something to eat. As I turned the corner, two white cops came out and put their guns in my face and said, "We're going to let you go. Just tell us where he is. Tell us who the man is." I'm like, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Well, you know, you're going to wear this because we got to get somebody." I said, "I don't know what you're talking about." And I actually went upstate for that the last time. Mm-hmm. And when I went upstate for that, that's when I got the letter from, because there was no evidence. There was no drug, no mark money, no nothing. And that's why they didn't really, that's why Charles Hines and the judge didn't really want to give me the time that they gave me. But they ended up giving it to
Ricochet,
me.
Ricochet, I'm going to have to cut you off because we only have about a minute and a half.
Okay,
and
let me hear,
I do
want to
hear how
let you. Me get to that point
okay,
real quick.
Okay, thank you.
All right, and what happens there is once I went away for that time, and I decided I'm going to not do the same thing and get the same results. So what I did is I decided I'm going to do something different in my life. I started staying away and out of the areas that I know there's high crime areas. And I went, like I said, I made some phone calls to a couple of different institutions of higher learning. And Mercy told me to come down and interview with them. I did. And they really liked me. And the rest is collegiate history. That's where I'm at.
Okay, so it sort of sounds like you, once you made up your mind to change your life and avoid situations that would put you back in prison, doors opened and
yes,
you walked through them.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for walking through our metaphorical door here and talking to our listeners about your situation. And we wish you all the best in school, and maybe we can keep in touch and do a follow-up show with you after you graduate.
Thank you very much for having me. I will really appreciate staying.